Let me welcome all of you to the introductory lecture for the International History Department this year, co-sponsored by the International History Seminar at the Institute for Historical Research. And a particular welcome, of course, to Professor Simon Sharma, who is our speaker tonight. Simon Sharma is Professor of History at Columbia University. He studied at Christ College, Cambridge, and held posts at Cambridge and Oxford before moving to Harvard University in 1980, and then later to Columbia. He has written on Dutch and French history, Citizens, a Chronicle of the French Revolution, which was published in 1989, was the first book to which I met Professor Sharma's writings, and certainly helped convince me that historians, even in the late 20th century, could write well and be analytically meaningful at the same time, something those of us who have an interest in going into history should put in mind, I think, when we listen to today's lecture. Professor Sharma has also written much on art history through his column in The New Yorker and in his magnificent biography, Rembrandt's Eyes, which came in 1999. To many, Professor Sharma is best known for having written and presented the 15-part series A History of Britain for BBC Television. His current book, which he will be presenting on tonight, Rough Crossings, Britain, the Slaves and the American Revolution, will also become a TV series to be shown in about 2 years' time. Is that about right?
Maybe,
yes. We hope. I'm sure the BBC will
it's
do that.
It's the maybe BC.
Yeah. I'd be very surprised.
We all paid our license fee.
Yeah. given what has happened in the past, if it's not shown, being X at the last moment would be a great surprise, I think, for that one. To me, I just finished reading the book. Rough Crossings is very much a book about freedom, about differing concepts of freedom. And seen through Simon Sharma's eyes, freedom is a very diverse matter, the content of which depends on who you define yourself to be. And that's, of course, a message that has a very high degree of contemporary as well as historical significance. Professor Sharma, welcome to the LSE. We're looking forward to hearing your lecture.
Thank you so much. Citizens. I was acclaimed, as they say, in the pages of Figaro when I wrote that book as being a Reaganite historian. So even though I'm not, it's probably the first Reaganite historian you've had in the LSE, isn't it?
No.
Isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, really?
I see a few of them wrong
here. Oh. Blimey, what a scary bunch, actually, here. You're so scary, really. But not scarier, I'm saying, reminiscing, that you're certainly not scarier than the sixth formers at NLCS, who I got to talk to on Thursday. And I remember going to Bristol Grammar years and years ago. It's a line of encouragement or admonition or threat, really, depending on how you read it. And the head of the History Society, a very tall boy, came up to me and said, hello, Mr. Sharma, said, we were so looking forward to your remarks. Could you manage to be entertaining? So we find not so many of the lads fall asleep that way. So I replied to him, and I replied to you, I shall do my pitiful best. What's a good day in the archive? Well, the good day for me was certainly the day when on a list of African-American escape slaves, now living in Preston, Nova Scotia, a village about 7 miles northeast of Halifax. And there's a list of people who are being asking the representative of the British government, 27-year-old naval lieutenant called John Clarkson, younger brother of the great abolitionist, agitator, and organizer Thomas Clarkson. They were asking him that when they went, as they hoped they would, to refound Sierra Leone, to refound Freetown, they might be kept together as a group of families, in effect, as a neighborhood. They've been a neighborhood in Preston, Nova Scotia, struggling against hideous odds, about which a bit more later. And they wished to be in the same vicinity with each other. It wasn't going to be a very large town, Freetown, when they went to Africa. And amidst those names was one name that jumped out of John Clarkson's diary, which is how I know about it. It's a trip he made in the early days of October 1791, and that name was British Freedom. And he appears just three times. We know very much about him in my story and in the story of this extraordinary migration, a migration which took tens of thousands of slaves towards the British ships and towards the British lines, and certainly away from the plantation world at the beginning of the Revolution, then at the end of the war into Nova Scotia, some others back into slavery in Jamaica and the West Indies, and eventually a tiny but very important significant number to Africa. So he appears just a few times in this story, but it was enough for me, because you don't have to be, we probably aren't anymore, are we, a post-structuralist, in order to realize that names mean something more than simply an indication. In his case, because he was very unlikely to have been called British Freedom in Virginia or Carolina or Georgia or wherever he had been a slave, meant something, was a choice. And behind that choice was something which seemed to me to turn the entire grand narrative of the American Revolution, interestingly, upside down. And it mattered to me on that day, because sometimes things do fall into place by magic, because the day I actually, British Freedom's name popped out from the villagers, list of villagers in Nova Scotia, was the day on which the winning design entry for the submission to rebuild what was already called the Freedom Tower, Ground Zero, was announced. It's Daniel Libeskind, you all know. And the salient fact about, the thing certainly grabbed the headlines, about this building, which is no longer recognizable in its many compromises that have been made, was that the Freedom Tower was to be exactly 1,776 feet high. And I'm one of those transatlanticists, literally spent half my life in America, who tends to have a doubled up passionate allegiance, both to the United States, which in every possible way, including intellectual freedom, has been extremely hospitable to me, at the same time that I have an unrepentant British passport and feel very strongly about stuff. Are we getting kind of shirt creak here, actually? Shirt Creek sounds like the name of a really good band, doesn't it, actually? Are we getting, like, you know, one of those Monty Python moments, really? Actually, Singing in the Rain, really. Where, are we getting too much Shirt Creek? Maybe I'll stand still, yeah. Those of you who know me say, yeah, right. So I won't stand still, I'll just have to live with it. So this, of course, despite the double allegiance, got seriously up the Sharma nose, which is, as you can all see, quite a large nose to get up. And I thought, 76 feet high, okay, then you mean freedom is invented when we depart. Tell that, I said, to British Freedom. He didn't think so. And, of course, there were between 80 and 100,000 slaves at the beginning of the Revolution who didn't think so either. In the spring of 1781, Lord Cornwallis's army camps for a few weeks by the side of the James River. And at that moment, it's near enough for there to be a breakout from the plantation of Thomas Jefferson. He loses 30 of his slaves. Jefferson, of course, the key figure of conflict, along with Washington, in this story, is utterly disarmingly frank, not only about his own losses, but also about how many slaves escape actually to the British during that period. And it's 30,000. That's an enormous number. Especially when you consider, really, that almost half the slaves in the South lived in Virginia, and enslaved African Americans constituted 10% of the entire population of the American colonies. It turned out to be the case, and other historians, as people have pointed out, have written very eloquently, if you're interested in this subject, and it's hard not to be, I think, there is already a very good historical literature, historians like Sylvia Frey, and Ellen Gibson Wilson and James Walker and Graham Russell Hodges in particular. So we know, we've gone over the figures for demographic credibility. But we don't have to rely on them. There's also Benjamin Quarles, who wrote a book about the Negro presence in the American Revolution, because they were so candid. We know, for example, there was almost nobody from the South who put their signature on the Declaration of Independence who did not lose slaves to the British. 1 week after Patrick Henry gets up in the Virginia House of Burgesses, bothering the hell out of me now, actually, I think I'm going to become immobile. Thank God for that, Bill. Will I get feedback? I don't mean intellectual either. So I'm going to switch off here.
and I'm just going to stand here like the professor I'm supposed to be. Okay. Off. Okay, so can you hear me through this mic? Okay, good, fine. So Arthur Middleton loses 50 slaves. A week after Patrick Henry gives the speech, you know, give me liberty or give me death, one of his slaves called Ralph Emery says, yes, thanks, I'll take liberty, and goes as fast as he can to the king's ships. George Washington actually loses one of his more favored slaves called Henry Washington, who goes to the British very early on while Washington is taking command in Cambridge Common. And it's one of you, not me. Who is creaking here, actually? Someone really old. it must be me. And so you have this extraordinary phenomenon by which the founders themselves are both witnesses to and very honest about what's going on. The central contradiction in the American Revolution, that a revolution is for liberty, in which the rhetoric of slavery and freedom had been used very freely, from Massachusetts to the Carolinas, was being taken seriously. People who were listening to this rhetoric of slavery and freedom, referring to whites during the Boston Tea Party, for example, had, of course, been house servants, blacks, as though they weren't there, as though they were indeed, in Ralph Ellison's phrase and title, invisible men. They were not invisible. They knew exactly what was being said and what its implications were. For example, there is Lund Washington. George Washington's cousin wrote to him in 1775, before the hostilities had even begun, saying basically there's not a man of them, referring to the slaves, that would not, if they could, escape to the British, quote, for liberty is sweet. Now, this is a truly astonishing to me. It certainly was astonishing to me, not a history I'd known about. I only knocked over it through a friend mentioning it at a lunch party and sending me to an excellent history of New York City by Michael Wallace. And I always forget the co-author's name. Someone will remind me. My apologies to him. Called Gotham, in which for the first time I encountered the fact that at the end of the war, about which a little more later, there were at least four, and probably I think now 5,000 free African Americans in New York, all of whom were supposed to be returned to their plantation origins, and were not, and were living under protection of the British. And this was the first moment at which I was genuinely startled into doing some work, following the bibliographic trail, and then following that trail into the archives. But as I say, there was a very clear sense of actually what a sort of difficult and painful contradiction it was. But it gets more interesting even than that, because it's quite clear to me, as Sylvia Fry rightly says, I push it a little bit further, I have to say, but in the spring and summer of 1775, in other words, after the first shots have been exchanged at Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill, but before the theater of war had started in any serious way in the South, the cause of white militia mobilization south of the Potomac was the terrified fear that the British were going to arm the slaves and the Native Americans. And, of course, the British had been arming Native Americans, manipulating Indian alliances all through the Seven Years' War. And so it was thought this was another piece of cynical manipulation, and to some extent it certainly was just that. But there was already a huge insurrection going on in Suriname and another one going on quite fiercely in the Caribbean, in Jamaica. So with the terror, I remember one letter, it's in the book, and I can't remember, and I don't really want to shuffle my pages, but I remember one Southern politician in Carolina, wish I didn't remember who it was, said hell could not have vomited forth a more diabolical scheme than the emancipation of our slaves. And it's said by somebody who's beginning the enterprise of American freedom. So look from that point of view. The guns go into white hands to begin a war which in the South is a war which says it's a war for freedom and is a war expressly for the protection and perpetuation of servitude. God, I'm going to be popular in America in the spring, aren't I? I didn't see how you can come to any other conclusion. And gee, what a surprise. This has not been part of the grand narrative of American history in high schools. I wonder why. It's a bit inconvenient. And it's also very important at this point not only to sort of see the kind of historiographical awkwardness of this and painfulness of it, really, but I wouldn't want American, what I hope will be, deeply wounded American self-congratulation, to which my American friends here may say, dream on, Sharma, but what I hope will be modified American self-congratulation, with British self-congratulation, which is to a large extent wholly unmerited. Not wholly unmerited, but mostly unmerited. There are British heroes in this book of mine. But it is a kind of, for me, a profound moment. And it is a moment also when, through almost inadvertent means, through if the British military strategy inaugurated by Lord Dunmore, when he, the famous proclamation in November 1775, when short of troops, with only 300 white troops, regular troops, and unable to be supplied by ship with reinforcements, does say in his proclamation that any Negroes from rebel plantations, if you're in a loyalist plantation, you're out of luck. But from rebel plantations, who would be able to serve the king will be rewarded with their freedom. And that inaugurates an extraordinary story. It begins with Dunmore's Ethiopian regiment, which go to battle wearing a badge on their uniform which says Liberty to Slaves. And they fight white militia, and they capture white militia. It's absolutely an extraordinary moment, extraordinary first. There are for the first time black NCOs, and through the war, escaped slaves fight for the British in many different kinds of capacity as irregular partisans in the Hudson Valley. A slave called Titus, who'd been called Titus in Monmouth County, New Jersey, turned into extraordinary guerrilla warrior Captain Ty, who inflicts incredible damage in New Jersey and Westchester on Patriot Continental Regular Army and Militia Barracks, and also on Patriot farms and homesteads. There are even black dragoons. In fact, Mel Gibson's, this will come as an incredible shock to you all, but The Patriot, Mel Gibson's film, is not completely and wholly accurate. You can do anything you want with me, providing it doesn't hurt. Yeah. Okay. Playing with me. I have to. Don't look, I'm unbuttoning. Is that fun? Okay, good. I liked it. Okay. Where the hell was I? Yes. Somewhere in New Jersey, I think, which isn't really not where you really want to be. So this is actually a remarkable moment, and as I just said a minute ago, I don't want American self-congratulation to be replaced by British self-congratulation, but it is nonetheless the case that throughout those... Oh, we were with Mel Gibson. Yes. You must have... Can't leave him alone. Yes, the shocking and surprising historical inaccuracy of The Patriot. Well, while in between the bits where, you remember this is also not only written by, as it turns out, sort of crazed Catholic fundamentalist, but also directed by a German. So, oops, I don't mention the war. Help, I've done it. But it got up my nose slightly again when, sort of British officer is given the lines, basically, sergeant, impale those babies or something like that, really. And the blacks all say, yo, massa, we fight for freedom, it's a rally to Mel. And it's exactly the opposite. In fact, as it turns out, Francis Marion, the figure on whom Mel Gibson's character is loosely based, did fight an engagement with blacks, or rather, I should say, against them, because there was actually a company of black dragoons, which I mentioned as a skirmish, but an amazing... At Wadby Plantation at the very end of the war. So there was black cavalry too. Mostly the thousands who fought actually in the British Army, and many more of those who escaped were in the van, or some of them, many tens of thousands, just sort of disappeared and hoped not to be returned. But most of them, of course, were sappers, ditch diggers, pilots, spies, cooks, laundresses. Some of them were given, of course, the most menial and difficult and awful jobs to do, were often deserted when they fell ill with the smallpox by British generals. But the most startling thing is often they weren't. There were junior officers in particular like James Patterson, for example, who was a genuine benefactor to David George, the Black Baptist preacher, who does get very sick with smallpox, and who sees that he's sort of rescued and clothed and reunited with his family. And all through the records, in the PRO, actually, in the, some of the dispatches, partly because there was one general in this parade of dunderheads and cynics and ne'er-do-wells and cowards who constitute the illustrious line of command in the British Army, Sir Henry Clinton, who is not great as strategy goes, but who sees himself as responsible for mobilizing the black pioneers, again, mostly sappers, but they were armed sappers. They were fighting sappers at the very important turning points in the war, Siege of Charleston, Savannah, and so on. Clinton really does take a day-to-day, well, week-to-week interest in seeing that these black soldiers, free black soldiers, are decently clothed, uniformed, provided for, fed, given inoculation, in fact. They are inoculated, often too late. So we know there are, the startling point is when there are, you know, there is at least one small crate of good British eggs, but there are. And through the entire story, you can see both who the scoundrels and who the good eggs are. That, to me, is startling. So even in the midst of something, a policy which has been launched with transparently cynical, expedient motives, actual good, not to mention actual liberty, does happen, in my view. And there is a kind of one telling moment at the end of the war, which is, I think, a super good egg moment, let me just track back to make one caveat, actually, before I leave the difficulties and painful embarrassments of measuring British motives against American motives. It will be said, correctly, that I don't spend a lot of time dealing with the black troops who fought on the American side, and I don't, because it's been written up much more intensively and elaborately than this more surprising story of black loyalism. And there were, but there weren't many. There's a figure of 5,000, which was launched by Benjamin Quarles, which is difficult, really, to, I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong, but it's hard, actually, to nail down as having a kind of reliable numerical basis. What we do know is at the beginning of the war, while Dunmore is recruiting his 800 or so of the Ethiopian regiment, and while the British, for whatever reasons, are making this deal with escaped blacks, the Americans are incredibly busy making sure no blacks, and even free blacks, would join the Continental Army. Especially this went for the provincial militias, the state of the colony of New Hampshire, becoming the state of New Hampshire, expressly excluded blacks along with, quote, lunatics and idiots from its militia. Washington, again, while very hard up for troops in Cambridge, or wanting more anyway, again, excluded blacks along with dotards, beggars, servants, and vagabonds from the army. It was only when the terror of actually a serious black British military presence became serious that, for example, the 1st Regiment Rhode Island of blacks was recruited, about 100 free black soldiers, essentially. There were many, many more blacks on the Continental side towards the end of the war, but guess what? They turn out to be overwhelmingly substitute soldiers for white soldiers who were, by then, so terrified of the utter collapse of the plantation system that they weren't going to leave the plantation. If it came to a choice between the birth of America or making sure your plantation was intact, you were going to opt for the latter and send your black soldiers to die at Yorktown. So it's a complicated issue of motives and consequences on both sides. I'm the first to argue about that. But here's a crucial turning point, really. And it's in 1783, and Washington, digression eating another digression and spitting it out again, but hey, it's history. I mean, Herodotus wasn't so pure with his structure either, was he? There is one figure who's utterly sincere about having a regiment of 3,000 black soldiers to fight on the American side, and that's John Lawrence, who's moving, if kind of fat-headedly idealistic life. I give you a potted biography in the book. He's the son of Henry Lawrence, a South Carolina politician from Charleston. And John really does not only see this bitter contradiction between a revolution purporting to be fought in the name of freedom, but actually in the South fought to perpetuate slavery, and he wants to change all that. In ways which Abigail Adams and Benjamin Franklin have been saying at the beginning of the revolution, if only we could be consistent. And Jefferson squirmed around, and Washington squirmed around. Lawrence wanted to do something about that. And he says, in a sort of sweet way, and it is likely to promote the course of abolition, which is precisely why it was instantly vetoed by the majorities, terrified and indignant majorities in the South. Now, it's a wonderful kind of miniature father-son story. Henry and John have very close relations. They write all the time. John goes off, is sent off as a diplomat. Then Henry is actually captured and sent to the Tower of London. And so we have a wonderful set of sources for them. And John is actually killed. It's very sad at the end of the war in a sort of totally unnecessary expedition against some British foragers. And his father, who sort of supported him a bit in this quixotic scheme to have a really major free black regiment in the American army, suddenly does the most extraordinary turnaround, or you could say reverts to type, because he goes to Paris in the very last days, in January 83, in the very last days of the negotiation of the treaty with between John Jay and the British plenipotentiaries, and he adds on the last day a specific article, Article 7 of the preliminary treaty, which says there shall be no carrying off of property and Negroes. And that puts Washington in a position of actually having to return all of those escaped blacks to their owners. And New York City, still under British control, New York is crawling with slave hunters. And we have, here I will rustle my my pages. We have some wonderful, yes, here it is. Two wonderful accounts, two memoirs written by two blacks who both become preachers, one a Methodist and one a Baptist, who'd been escaped slaves and who'd been in the British Army in different capacities. One of them is called Boston King, who ends up as a Methodist. So he writes his memoir when he comes to a Methodist seminary or college in England in 1798. And he remembers incredibly vividly what it was like at that particular moment. And he says, he writes about the, quote, inexpressible anguish and terror as we saw our old masters coming from Virginia, North Carolina, and other parts and seizing on their slaves in the streets of New York or even dragging them out of their beds. Many of the slaves had very cruel masters, so that the thoughts of returning home with them embittered life to us. For some days we lost our appetite for food and sleep departed from our eyes. But he notes, and he goes on, the English had compassion on us in the day of our distress. And if it sounds very biblical, this is, of course, the natural speech, both spoken and written, of this first generation of historians of a self-determined black British African-American community. And many of the English in New York do indeed live up to that rather lofty billing. And one particular is not an abolitionist, not a humanitarian, just a regular old, you know, dash after the foxes country gentleman gone into the army, but a genuinely good soul called Sir Guy Carleton, and this is his moment. And there's a summit conference in Old Japan, just on the New Jersey side of the Hudson, in a little place which you can still visit, sweet little kind of New Jersey Dutch house called the DeWint House. And the entire purpose of the conference, it's the general rubric is organizing the terms of the British evacuation and an exchange of prisoners. But the purpose, as far as Washington was concerned, was to make sure that all these escaped slaves were indeed returned, because he was being hounded by his neighbors in Virginia to get them back. And there's this moment in this place where Carleton says, well, my dear general, you know, I'm happy to oblige. The loyal Westchester volunteers will be decommissioned and we'll be out of here as soon as we can. And Washington says, well, but the matter on the table essentially is this. And Carleton goes on as if, you know, he hadn't really heard that and said, well, of course, some of our ships have already embarked and they carried with them certain people to whom His Majesty has an obligation. He has an obligation to people of all color. He uses that phrase. And Washington is described by the loyalist reporter of that occasion as reddening and furiously says, "What, already embarked?" And Carlton simply says, I'm paraphrasing now because I can't be bothered to, I'm too embarrassed to open the page of my book. Yes, there are certain things I am actually embarrassed about. And says he was sure that General Washington would not ever wish to assume that he, Sir Guy Carleton, would be capable of so violating any obligation that His Majesty had entered into in good faith with those same people of all colour. And there's a furious row at that moment, and it's unsolvable, unless Washington wanted to restart the war, which he doesn't. And finally, Washington says it's dinner time, and they convene for, rather appropriately, bitters. Amazingly, as I discovered, a small point, a piece of anecdotal colour, there's a tent outside, and it's run by the man who owns Francis Tavern, who is black, Sam Francis, actually. And both sides are entertained by somebody who absolutely chose the American side. There's a little kind of free black scenario there. So, in fact, the blacks do go off with the British ships to Nova Scotia. But in an attempt to appease some of this problem for Washington, Carleton had said he would make a rule, which was, I suppose, fair enough, that only those escaped African Americans who had actually come within British lines before the treaty was concluded, in other words, in good faith to serve in the British Army, would be entitled to these extraordinarily important documents. I mean, for the first time in British New York, understand this, black marriages were legal. For the first time, children were born from slave families could be legally baptized. They were holding this little scrap of paper which said born free behind British lines. They held another certificate if they passed a little committee examination showing that they had indeed arrived in British lines when they said they did, which was a thing called a General Birch Certificate, a GBC. Samuel Birch was the commandant of the British garrison charged with this job. These were called Birch Certificates, and it said, His Excellency General Sir Guy Carleton gives the bearer of this document leave to go wherever he or she pleases and to do whatsoever he or she pleases. This is a revolutionary, obviously, an incredibly important, moving, revolutionary little document to hold. But there are hearings, both at Francis Tavern and actually on the dockside and sometimes even on the ships, joint commission, half American, half British, to determine these things. And they draw up, Carleton says, with an eye to compensating masters in America who lost their slaves to freedom. British offered compensation. It was never given in the end. There was a negotiation dragged on about what that compensation might be, and there was a kind of round sum, more or less arbitrarily agreed, not until, I think I'm right in saying, the 1820s, maybe even a little later than that. But the book is called The Book of Negroes, and what it does is record in amazingly illuminating micro detail. There are two or three lines on each of the 3,000 blacks who were examined. How old they were, when they'd left, when they'd escaped, where they'd come from, what their physical condition was like, who they'd escaped with. In other words, if there was a kind of granny who escaped with a kind of 10-year-old, you know all about that. So for the first time, you actually know, you've got faces and names and personal histories. Then it's not just a kind of generic group of people involved in this extraordinary, epic exodus of suffering, hope, and possible redemption. These are real people, and you can trace some of them, like John Keisel or Mary Perth. You can trace them from Africa. You can trace when they've been sold in Virginia. You can trace when they've been escaped from the plantation, when they'd gone to the British lines, where they'd served the British, what they'd done, what their position, what their health, what their size, what their physical look was at that moment in New York. So it's just an astonishing document. It's been edited and published, by the way, by Graham Russell Hodges as The Book of Negroes. And it's something, again, that, you know, along with this whole extraordinary story, ought to be known better in the grand narratives of high school in America and places beyond. So we have all these stories of these little exoduses. We know, for example, one amazingly, to me, thrilling and important fact that emerges from these biographies is that while before the war, 80% of all escaped slaves were men, It's more or less almost half and half. It's like 55 to 45%. An extraordinary number of women make the flight to freedom, often with very small children. Some children seem to band together themselves and actually escape from plantations when their parents or went missing or just by that. I didn't mean tiny children, but I certainly mean 11, 12, and 13-year-olds. That's astonishing, at least to me, in itself. And they travel in groups, and we know pretty much exactly how they travel. They almost travel out of the plantations at night. They take boats. Remember that many of them are generally, as you would expect, not just field hands. They're always led by some of the skilled slaves on plantations, sawyers, coopers, pilots, woodcutters, millwrights, among them famously as Thomas Peters, whom I call the first identifiable African-American politician, I think he is, who becomes a sergeant in the British Army and the British Pioneers. He'd been born in West Africa. He's sold to a plantation owner in Wilmington, North Carolina. He is sworn into the army, into Sir Henry Clinton's army by a captain called Captain Thomas Martin. Is wounded twice in engagements. He is one of those fighting sappers. And Peters becomes a force to be reckoned with, particularly in Nova Scotia, because what happens is a story of tragic betrayal, really, and disillusionment. Some of the slaves who'd emigrated with the British, but not all of them, from Charleston and Savannah were... became a free black population in Jamaica, but meant some were also resold unconscionably into slavery. The New York population are not. They remain absolutely and unequivocally free, but what they do not get in Nova Scotia, gee, what a surprise, are the 100 acres to which they're entitled. They get 20 if they're lucky, and almost always on unworkable land. It would have been workable only if, in fact, they'd been given a loan of a team of oxen, which could clear felled tree stumps, which are a serious proposition in Nova Scotia, and clear the land with these huge, bald granite rocks, which are everywhere. And because this doesn't happen, they fall into terrible destitution, and they become a force to indenture their children and themselves sometimes. They are, as one of the most moving things, actually, about the black population who go through this extraordinary ordeal, is that the English common law means something incredibly important to them. If you want to say, well, how early on did they ever arrive at the notion that the British might be real emancipators, we know from runaway notices that black slaves, that slaves in Virginia and the South in 1773 and 1774 know about the Mansfield judgment in the case of James Somerset, an escaped slave in London, who finally gets awarded the judgment that such escaped slaves could not be coerced against their will, sorry for the redundancy, could not be coerced and ambushed and resold into slavery. Mansfield had wanted that ruling to be ad hominem and very narrow. He had not wanted it to mean slavery was impossible under the terms of the English common law. The famous phrase, the air of England is too pure for a slave to breathe. But, tough luck, it was actually interpreted as making slavery illegal in Britain itself, not least by the 200 black spectators who were in Westminster Hall on the day of that judgment. And more surprisingly are the runaway notices in Virginia which say Pompey, Scipio, Cato, Phoebe, Sally, gone to the British under the deluded belief that Lord Mansfield's judgment has set them free, that liberty, that slavery is impossible in Britain. So we know that that intelligence, as it were, Abigail Adams, who's touring the South, writes about exactly the same thing, had happened. So there's this strong faith that the English common law is going to come to their rescue. And if you're British, you can't be a slave. It's simple as that. It's against all the betrayals, all the desertions, all the hypocrisy that we were capable of, that faith is sustained. There is never a moment in the entire war, even after the treaty is signed and some black boat gangs, military gangs, are still operating on the Hudson, there is never a moment at which more blacks don't come to the British than go to the Americans. It's an amazing, almost undeserved compliment, an act of faith. So in Nova Scotia, they go to the courts, and sometimes they actually win their cases. For example, when there's a woman who's disgracefully deceived, thinks she signed a document indenturing her for 1 year. She's in fact signed it for 39 years. She's encouraged by literate friends and neighbours to go to the courts, and they don't always lose. They sometimes win. But it's enough of a situation of grief. Also, I should say that in this experience, so if I go like that, you can't hear me. Okay. I'm getting bored with standing still. Don't fidget, Simon, my French teacher always used to say. Don't fidget. Why not? In Nova Scotia, they go to the courts, they sometimes win, but it's important to understand that what's happening, clearly what's happened actually on this extraordinary exodus, I suspect in the army, although there are no documents in my knowledge that we can use which tell us much about this, the formative institutions of African, American freedom and solidarity. Well, I'm sure they existed in the plantations, of course, actually, but they take a huge leap forward. What do I mean by that? The first free black schools operate in Nova Scotia. The first free black British churches. David George is arguably, I think, the first free black pastor of a Baptist community in the South. And above all, the first African-American politics, the first African-American politics, obviously not first African politics. And Peters, the sergeant in the Pioneers, is an extraordinary example of this. He's half literate. He can write a little bit. We know that from Granville Sharp's correspondence. But mostly, when he comes into contact with the abolitionist community in London and the black community in London, it's a kind of collaboration. But whatever was the case, he's already writing petitions in New Brunswick and in Nova Scotia to the governors of those two Canadian provinces, bitterly complaining about the king's wishes not being carried out in respect of land and in respect of the basic obligations that were supposed to have been discharged to the black soldiers and their families. Finding no satisfaction, he manages to get his passage all the way across to London at the end of, towards the end, to the autumn of 1790. We don't quite know whether he worked his passage or whether there were real benefactors of the black community, almost all of them Quakers in Halifax, and principally in Halifax. So I suspect one of them, Lawrence Hartshorn, who had connections in the shipping business, probably got Peters's passage. When he's there in London, he meets Granville Sharp, the first great autodidact hero of the abolitionist movement, and together they work on a petition, say the same thing with more indignant eloquence, an incredible document actually, because it appeals to the British Constitution, uses the phrase, as being in effect in the world of the Enlightenment a colorblind document, and digs out all the case history of slavery, of the air of England being too pure for a slave to breathe. They do get the ear of the government. Through Oleoda Equiano, I'm sure, and through Ottobah Kuguano, but they reach Thomas Clarkson, they reach Wilberforce, and in the end they reach Pitt. And it's a crucial moment, this moment towards the end of 1790, because two things have happened. One is that the crusade to abolish a slave trade is reaching a parliamentary climax, which ends in defeat, but rather remarkably, 88 MPs vote for it in early 1791. So there are mass meetings all over Britain. This is an issue very much in the front line of politics. And secondly, an early initiative to found Sierra Leone in 1787 by Granville Sharp on the lines of a self-governing colony, an amazing sort of experiment in devolved authority involving Granville Sharp's sentimental reawakening of an Anglo-Saxon Gothic tradition of freedom based on tithing men and hundred doors and people who would elect from a street, who would elect a representative, who would elect a representative, some of which comes true in Sierra Leone. But that community of 300 veterans from the war who'd come to London, the so-called poor blacks, had been wiped out by a Temne raid in 1790. So the moment had come when the government wanted to make Sierra Leone a reality as a free black community in Africa and a commercially prosperous one, which would, as those who had dizzying ideas about what Africa might come, thought it would be the seed of a free trading relationship between Britain and free Africa, and would eventually wipe out by pure Adam Smithian economic impulse the profits of slavery itself. That was the idea. So they think, well, you know, these 400 of them are not enough. They weren't educated enough. They weren't hardy enough. But look, this community in Nova Scotia, which they know about through Thomas Peters, is tough and strong and educated. They've come through utter misery. Maybe they can refound this place in the image of British freedom. So they send Peters back with a document which says the following can happen to those who are indignant and distressed. Either you can stay put, and we will guarantee that you do get the land you promised, if you feel this will never happen because the promises will be betrayed by callow, perfidious white people in Nova Scotia. You have a choice of either joining the Free Black Army of black soldiers in the West Indies. Only, I think, two people take that up. What a surprise. Camp Jamaica. Don't think so. We will take you to Sierra Leone. We will transport you free. We'll give you land, and then you're on your own. But we will do that for you. And we will see that it's to be done. But they send Peters, but they think, well, Peters had been circumnavigated by the worst that Nova Scotian bureaucracy could throw at him. So they needed someone white, in effect, to do it as well. And they pick, I think, Thomas Clarkson and Wilberforce pick Thomas Clarkson's younger brother, John Clarkson, who is a figure straight out of Patrick O'Brien, high-strung, romantic, neurotic, evangelical, full of sweet idealism and the load of sin and corruption, which he almost instantly thinks is going to make him both incompetent and unworthy to fulfill his mission. What's interesting about John Clarkson, many things are interesting about John Clarkson, but he'd served in the Navy, the Royal Navy, as a baby midshipman, and then worked his way to, you know, next stage up to eventually to lieutenant in the Caribbean theater during the American Revolution, where he had shown absolutely no sign of any queasy conscience about the world of the slaves. He saw whatsoever, not a peep. It was when he went back to Britain on half pay and his brother Thomas had turned into the greatest and most eloquent and most relentless and tireless of all the abolitionists that baby John, little baby brother, has a kind of genuine moment of Saul on the road to Damascus. He becomes an utter convert. In fact, at least as much of a zealot as his big brother. He becomes his secretary and amanuensis, and because he knew the slave trade, is responsible for getting some of those damning, extraordinary figures about conditions on slave ships out for the campaign. So he's eager to go, but he's also uncertain about it too, about his own fitness for the job. And just before they part company in the early autumn, in the autumn of 1791, Thomas, the older brother, has this neat idea. He says, keep a journal. It can be of great use to us in the campaign. And Clarkson then writes 800 pages, three-volume diary, which is one of the most extraordinary documents, actually, I think, in late 18th century romantic literature, I would have to say, not just history or politics. It needs a really good critical edition. It's nearly all of it is available online. If you punch in John Clarkson, you'll find it. If you Google it, you'll find it. I think the Black Loyalist Heritage website, very good website, out of Nova Scotia has published it, and I think the University of Sierra Leone too. So you can read it, but somebody here, I hope, will be moved to do a really terrific print edition of it, critical edition. Anyway, we have this extraordinary document. And Clarkson is this, he's someone who has 2 years or so where he's possessed by an historical destiny against which he fights. He sees himself as kind of Moses figure, and he's called the Moses figure by the blacks themselves. And remember, Moses was kind of a reluctant stammerer, very reluctant to actually take up the challenge of the burning bush, and so is Clarkson. He worries that he's going to be undercut by people at home about what he's delivering the blacks to, but he has this amazingly fierce emotional burden of guilt about what the European Enlightenment or what 18th century Europe, I'm trying to find the, had really done to this particular community. So he wants it to go all right. He doesn't want to make promises he can't actually fulfill. For example, he says that he didn't want to sell the Sierra Leone scheme too strongly, lest he's responsible for persuading people to do something which turns out to be terribly dangerous. He says in his diary, I want them to make their own choice, for I consider them as men, having the same feelings as myself, and therefore I did not dare to sport with their destiny. So another point, when he gets to Nova Scotia and all of what he'd heard by hearsay about the betrayals and the deceits and the conspiracies and the suffering which the Nova Scotians, blacks, had gone through, I'll just skim the surface of what had been happening. He writes in his diary, if these poor unfortunate men... Well, he said, he writes back to his brother and to Wilberforce, said, if anyone, you know, is sending me on a fool's errand, I will do something, as he puts it, of violent desperation. These poor unfortunate men have, ever since Europe called herself enlightened, sneer, experienced the greatest treachery, oppression, murder, and everything that is base. I cannot name an instance when a body of them collected together have ever had the promises made to them performed in a conscientious way. Recollecting that these people were in peace and quietness before they put their confidence in me, weren't quite in peace and quietness in Nova Scotia, recollecting that I shall be at a loss supposing we meet with resistance in Africa, for example. They're going to a place full of slave traders. I shall be at a loss to convince them of the integrity and real feeling of my heart towards them. And I do declare that you will never see me more if anything of the kind should happen, for I will sacrifice my life in the defense of the meanest of them on board sooner than they should entertain a doubt of the sincerity of my intentions. Look, yes, he's part of this rhetoric of coming from the corrupt world of civic republicanism, of fashion, of polite society. He's in search of some sort of black version of Rousseau's transparently pure citizen. But nonetheless, he puts his sort of life on the line, as he actually does, disease, fighting, all sorts of things. And he makes this happen. There is one moment which ought to be in every schoolbook in this country, where he gets into the pulpit of this free black town, which you should also know about, called Birchtown, free black community, schools, farms, just about hanging on, just across the bay from Shelburne in South Nova Scotia. And he reads the official document that the government has drawn up. And with all the caveats and all the kind of caveats about how he says, well, he hopes that the problems of climate have been overrepresented, but maybe the soil isn't as good as some of the promoters of Sierra Leone might suggest. So he wants them to think very carefully before selling their land. But again, he makes a speech which is extraordinary, really, coming from anybody white at that time, I think, because he understands one crucial thing, of course, that many of these people, not all of them, but, you know, a sizable number, will have are completing the arc, that they actually, the last time they crossed the Atlantic was in fetters, as slaves, and that this is going to be a very traumatic and powerful moment for them. And he promises to them that they will be treated, quote, as passengers, not slaves. And he gives orders to the captains of this 15-ship fleet that they are to do exactly that. And so far as we can tell, actually, that happens. The seamen and sailors are not to abuse the blacks, either verbally or in any other way. And extremely minute regulations, all of which were observed, about food, hygiene, sanitation, discipline. In return, he creates black companies of free blacks, which are the kind of mustering companies of the blacks themselves, of which, of course, Thomas Peters and his friend in the British Army, Murphy Steele, are officers. And so eventually... And very often, of course, actually, there's an extraordinary period of months over the winter, delayed by weather, where just staggering epics happen. Five blacks who we know about, who had escaped, who had served in the army, now in New Brunswick, are being prevented from boarding a ship because they lost their General Birch certificates, led by a preacher called Richard Karankapone. And they walk hundreds of miles in wintry conditions. One of them gets frostbite, foot has to be amputated, doesn't make it all the way to Halifax. The rest carry on. They walk all the way around Nova Scotia to Halifax. Other moments where a child cannot be rescued by indentures legally. Indentures not completed. So what is a free family to do? They're going to leave the child behind or not go? Clarkson says, steal him. Just lock him away, hide him, we'll get him on the ship, happens. Sometimes he goes down his knees once to beg a woman to actually prevent a family from having to separate and release the girl from the indentures, and the white woman fails to do so. The scenes at the sugar house, paradoxically, which is where they're being lodged before they get on the boats, where the Baptist and Methodist pastors are extremely important. And Clarkson, I describe it again, his diary entry is very touching. Every so often, feeling an attack of unworthiness come on, and he says, I gave way to hysterics. I can't believe he wasn't Jewish somehow, actually, you know, for us. And he wasn't, so strictly C of E. So he gives way to hysterics and describes, and has to go and lie down. It's a lot of going to lie down in John Clarkson's diary. I love him, obviously. He's my kind of hero. He backs into it, you know. So he goes, and he goes to hear David George and what the Baptist chapel inside the sugar house, and he hears what we all know, the incredibly beautiful, powerful voice of what will become gospel music, of him singing. And he has to reach for his handkerchief several times and sit down. And he feels that at some point, he says, David George was so exalted by his sermon that he feared for his wits and hoped he would calm down there. Clearly not Jewish, but British. Wants him to sort of tighten up a little bit. So they sail off. And Clarkson himself, and I'm going to stop, I've gone on much too long, but Clarkson himself, as a kind of token of good faith, decides that the flagship will be the hospital ship. And his best friend at that point is a man called Charles Taylor, who's a Nova Scotia physician, also genuinely good egg, believes in the whole importance, historical, extraordinary importance of this moment. And they travel together on a hospital ship called Lucretia, and they run into a seriously rough crossing. And when they get to Nova Scotia, when they get to Sierra Leone, because the fleet had been delayed, all manner of horrors and difficulties and deaths. 65 people die on the crossing, actually. Children are born, and all sorts of ordeals which you can read about take place. But, you know, 1,000 of them make it. The first streets are set out. A real free black community, until it's annexed by the British Empire, takes place. What a surprise. And for the first time in the history of the world, as far as I can tell, somebody correct me, women vote. And who are those women? They're free, black, British, African-American women. Elected juries, elected constables. Taxes are raised by the blacks themselves. Farms, some of them work, some of them don't. One of the women whose life story you can trace all the way back to Africa the first time round, Mary Perth, becomes a great kind of powerhouse of upriver trading. They sort of survive. They manage to survive, not all of them, the temptation to shockingly go back into slaving themselves. One or two don't, but most of them, of course, do. So it becomes an extraordinary moment. I describe the moment where white British sailors are accused and convicted of calling the blacks in Sierra Leone black rascals and are sentenced to be flogged. And they're flogged by a black constable called Simon Proof in front of all the white seamen and soldiers and crews and the blacks themselves. It's an astonishing moment. And Clarkson gives one of his many sermons, which endeared him to nobody except, certainly endeared him to the blacks. Well, I don't want to go on any longer. The Sierra Leone story is itself extraordinary. Professor Christopher Fife has written brilliantly on this. I was just really taking crumbs from the very rich table he sets out in his wonderful books on this, including amazingly moving edition of the letters written by blacks to Clarkson once he returns to Britain. The directors in London all suspect him correctly of having gone native, much too, and when he comes back to London on sick leave and berates them for incompetence and insolence and arrogance, they decide he's got to go, and they do indeed manage to get rid of him. But this experiment in politics goes on. The thing about experiment in democratic politics or pseudo-democratic, well, it's not pseudo-democratic politics, I'd say it's sort of early democratic politics, is that, of course, it produces contention. It produces little revolts. And the thing which most rankled through the history of early Sierra Leone is this thing called the quit rent, which is a form of kind of council tax, a bit like, you know, the community tax, really, which Clarkson, because he'd been told this in the pulpit had explicitly promised the settlers who left would not be imposed on them, because it had been imposed at an outrageous rate in Nova Scotia. And then he was faced with having to say, I was wrong. We've all been betrayed. And that goes on rankling, and it causes, in the end, after Clarkson's gone, a rebellion, a serious rebellion. And two of the rebels, we know, are Henry Washington and British Freedom. And to that extent, at least, those two did finally, I guess, because it's a rebellion about taxation and representation, finally become American. Thanks for hearing me.
It's a presentation that is, in the true sense of the word, thought-provoking, and I hope it has provoked some thoughts among the audience. We are not having the best of days with microphones, I think, around here. Anyway, I'll just leave a couple of minutes for Simon to catch his breath, and for those of you who have to leave, we'll set off 15-20 minutes or so for questions.
Sure, yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. I was just probably swaying back and forth. I'm sure. Oh, I see. It was that. Okay. Yeah.
Is that microphone one? So maybe I
can. It could be. You can use it.
I promise that.
You can grab it.
Do that.
Good. Okay.
All right. Could you please make your way to the exit? Those of you have to leave rather fast. Yeah.
Pick up the exam papers at the back as you go out, would you?
We do an oral tomorrow on this.
So, let's...
Okay, let me, while people are making their way up, just start with the first question, really relating to an election we're going to have later on this year. Professor Gordon Wood, Brown University. Is going to be here, and is going to talk about, if you like, his side of the American Revolution. And as the author of a book called Radicalism of the American Revolution, I think he would probably take issue with some of the...
All of it,
well, probably next to all of it, yes. Is there more diversity on the American side, on the patriot side, that you give the impression of in your lecture in the book? I mean, is this something that you have thought about, that you cut back on in terms of where you focus is, in terms of your research, in terms of the fascinating story that you tell? Or is it something that's better left for another project, or is it something that could have been given a stronger voice here?
Well, I'm sure that is the major criticism I'm going to run into, and it is certainly the case that there are mixed feelings and tormented souls, the John and Abigail Adams, but they've got a war to fight. I mean, it's absolutely correct to say that the blacks who do serve on the American side contain within them, it sustains the kernel of their belief that the Republic of Freedom will eventually deliver it, and it's also absolutely true to say, which I do say, that the slave trade were abolished in the same year in the United States and in Britain. So there's no particular British credit on that side. On the other hand, of course, slavery isn't. If you are kind of making huge shop window claims about actually refounding, turning the world upside down in the name of a new kind of freedom, you really have an immense problem. Franklin was correct to rebound the kind of accusations of hypocrisy that the British abolitionists were constantly charging him with by saying, he did it feebly sometimes by saying, you have slaves too, they're called coal miners in Scotland, so on, that's idiotic. But he had a point in a way which said, not just you started it, the slave trade, but there is the Caribbean, notice that, absolutely fair point. And secondly, he would say, you have to understand there are these hundreds of thousands of enslaved people in our country, and how many are there
you know, 5,000, 15,000, turns out to be like sort of 7,000 or 8,000. So it's all very well for you to sound so damn morally superior. So it was, in that sense, sort of there was a point. There was a good point to all that. Nonetheless, really, for me, that kind of sticking point about the good faith and honor of what American freedom was supposed to be was that moment in between Washington and Carlton, was the father of the man, the only man from the South who was prepared to honor a sense that American freedom meant a big regiment of black soldiers rather than just substitutes who were fighting in place of white soldiers. His father then says, "We want our Negroes back, and we want them now." That seems to me a killer moment for the case that this is the radical revolution, I have to say. No doubt he and I will debate this. Very sure. Unequal odds, I think. Scary sure. as hell. Will. Yes, lady at the back.
Yes.
Defense of Americans.
In
your research, did you come across documents, memoirs, or anything like that of the group? Like, for example, my ancestors from upstate New York, who were revolutionaries, patriots, but were rabid abolitionists to the point that there was a whole group of them that after this, for example, went on to be abolitionists. I mean, did you not find that?
Yes, absolutely. But
They were not part of Franklin's group. They were kind of more or less isolated, Huguenots.
Right,
that
but the date
thing.
Is very, very important. Of course, slaves are being manumitted in the North. That's why I'm very careful to say that this is not an indictment of the Patriot side. It's an indictment of the Patriots below the Potomac in the slave world. That the contradiction which they're saddled with for them isn't a contradiction. They're the business of creating America in Georgia was business of creating a slave America. What I'm saying, in effect, is that the grand narrative of American history makes a flattering disconnect between the American the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. Let's say there's a prelapsarian moment where, for all the tragedy that went on in the 19th century, this moment was a moment where America can say we had a history of truth, virtue, courage, integrity, and liberty. But guess what? You can't. Not south of the Potomac, you can't. Slaves are being manumitted. Some are manumitted in the war. The pace picks up genuinely. But I tell you, if you want to look as an abolitionist at the great early abolitionist document, black documents, David Walker, do you know that amazing, right? One Universal Cry, or the extraordinary story of Frederick Douglass's lecture tour of Britain, which if you don't know it, I recommend it's the most amazing story of Britain in 1845. Those first generation of articulate, angry black abolitionists see England, Britain, they often say Britain as their protector. They are grotesquely over-generous to the British. Over-generous, ludicrously idealistic, utopian. Douglass is constantly saying that the British treated me as a man, whereas treated even those who looked after me as an animal in Washington, for example. He's only thrown out of a coach. So in some sense, this story, this kind of back text, has created, if you like, a myth of British freedom, when you're absolutely right to say there are individual family histories, especially in the years after the Revolution, of all kinds of honorable and politically courageous and active participation in the abolition movement. It's just there are history really does have turning points, I think, actually, and this was one of them.
Yeah, fair question.
So one minor question first. Do you have a number for the number of blacks who fought for the British? You say 5,000 is the one.
Yeah, well, it's actually, you add together, it's really hard, I have to say, because we know about the numbers who try and escape, and that's a very large number. It's a tiny number who fight for the British. But for example, you have a sort of, we're talking about, I think, maximum 5,000 actually serving in the front lines.
So it might
sieges.
Be the same number for both sides, then.
Yes, it might be the same number for both sides, that's quite true.
I don't know what you've noticed, in the latest edition of the New York Review of Books, there's an article by, I think it's Edmund Morgan, but sorry?
It's Gordon Wood.
Right. Anyway, Gordon Wood reviewing a book by a man called Nash, who's writing about the American Revolution.
Yeah, Gary Nash,
yeah.
Yes, right.
And
Gary
he's
Nash
got
calls
into
black.
Before. Right. But the kind of line that Gordon Wood takes It's simply, all right, there's so many people fought for the British, blacks fought for the British. Right. Most of them died of smallpox. The British weren't overly interested. And in any case, what's this really got to do with the great achievements of the American Revolution? It doesn't detract from the Constitution, freedom and everything, the great men, Washington, Jefferson, etc., and rather poo-poos the significance of the...
Well, I guess you have to tell that to Frederick Douglass, who talked about your 4th of July.
But are you prepared for this kind of reaction from the...
Oh, I'm assuming that, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Am I prepared? I don't suppose so, you know, but I'm not going to kind of leave town and head for Paraguay or something, you know, I shall fight my corner. That is precisely, you know, it has everything to do with it. It strikes me as profoundly cynical and callow to say... the fact that Jefferson was forced to strike the clause, you know, the paragraph in the Declaration of Independence abolishing slavery, certainly abolishing the slave trade because of the veto by the southern states, doesn't reflect on a slight problem we have here with a brand new world of liberty. It's preposterous, I think, really. But I mean, your first caveats are quite true. And I think, I mean, a woman called Elizabeth Venn has written a fantastic book called Pax Britannica, which tells in detail a story of the smallpox-stricken troops. But it's sort of insulting, I think, to the black memory, actually, I have to say that this wasn't significant, you know, that these people who actually hung on to the idea of freedom in English common law in Nova Scotia and Sierra Leone, you know, it's all kind of just a kind of footnote to the history of the Limeys. Fuck off, sorry.
Okay, we'll take a question up there, yes.
Oops. Probably won't say that in the Your Review of Books, but I might.
I think you probably should. Yes, please.
Lord Dunmore's Promise of Liberty, the Mansfield Judgment, the...
Where are you?
I'm up here.
Oh, yeah, hi.
The slave rebellions in 1772. What is there a connection, do you think, between these and the Declaration of Independence itself? In other words, could the Declaration of Independence have been a preemptive move to keep this momentum in check and thereby keep the slaves in place?
Yes, it could. It could. That is exactly the problem with the stricken Jefferson draft. Yes. And Washington's decision, really, not to make it an issue and to keep blacks out of the early militias. Yes, it could. It could have, absolutely. There were probably, you know, more enthusiasts of the possibility of change on the American side at that point than cynical British generals and people in London with extremely mixed feelings. But they didn't. They kind of decided, you know, made that decision aggressively not to do it. It is also the case that before hostilities start, it's quite clear that from those runaway advertisements in Virginia and so on. I mean, it's scattered anecdotal evidence, but it sure, you know, is eloquent to me. It is sort of an important issue, I think, actually, that there was a kind of an intelligence, as it said, of what had happened in the Mansfield case, actually, and a kind of mythology of British freedom had been established. At that moment, before the Revolutionary War starts. So you imagine, but you have to imagine it, you know, debates about prudence and hope really going on among the world of the slaves at exactly that point. And you're right, that could have been utterly preempted. The American Revolution could indeed have been what it promised had it gone through with that, but it didn't.
We'll take a couple of more questions. Could I please ask the stewards to switch off the microphones that you are holding in between questions? Okay. Yeah, the back over there.
Does this mean American freedom is simply a house built on sand? Two more questions, if you don't mind. Will the Americans ever accept...
One would be enough, thanks.
Will the Americans ever accept this, and should I feel proud to be British?
Of course you should be proud of British. What's the civilization that gave you kippers, for example? You know? Christ's sake. You know. I take that's a rhetorical question. Is American freedom built on sand? Well, you know, it's too large. Let's put it this way. The history of modern America since its birth has this extraordinarily difficult complication built into it. But in some sense, it makes it face the issue of the truth and the untruths of freedom. If your skin doesn't happen to be white and you don't happen to be Jewish or Scottish or Italian or something. And that's, you know, something that's been faced since the abolitionist movement got going. So in some sense, there is a kind of tragic relentlessness about having to face that argument when, you know, the latest episode of which was on our television screens with the poor and the black left behind in New Orleans. So that story goes on. In Britain, we've really kind of only had to face it, you know, since the end of the empire, since we've become a multicultural society. So we had this sort of, I'm prepared to accept that it's thought to be a kind of limey luxury to be able to lecture Americans really on their difficulties.
One more question up there in the center.
The question of freedom and slavery, when one speaks to Americans, they'll have you believe that it's a Southern problem. Is this a Southern problem or an American problem?
Yeah, fantastically. So why is the best question always? Well, all the other questions were great too. The last one. No, my is a sort of preemptive defensive move to say that you can clearly see the mobilization of American force in the South as engineered to protect slavery at that moment. But you're absolutely right in the sense in which the language in which America decided to articulate its own beginning made it an American problem in the North as well as the South. And famously, of course, Abraham Lincoln, you know, the great patriarch of emancipation, only gets emancipation at an extremely, extremely late stage. So it's always been an American problem, I think, rather than just a Southern problem. When there's Southern migration to create the kind of communities of blacks in the Northern cities, it becomes again an immensely important Northern problem. That's right. It's just that if you look at, if the question was asked earlier about, isn't it the case that there is diversity among the patriot side, and there are patriots who are committed to giving freedom to those blacks who fought in the Continental Army, they are sort of overwhelmingly, really, in the North at that point. It's a question of how the nation could be held together. The issue is very well set out in Gary Will's book called The Negro President, where he says one of these Faustian moments is when the South, and Jefferson in particular, managed to push through the notion that a slave counts demographically when the Constitution is being written as two-thirds of a person, and secure for themselves a veto over the possibility of a federal abolition of slavery. That's another of these amazing deals with the devil, I think, which is an American problem. He's an American president. He's not the president of a Southern America. And that problem about is it an American or a Southern issue is the Civil War, isn't it? Yeah.
Mr. Sherman, thank you very much for a wonderful lecture, fascinating lecture. For those few of you who happen to be here and are British and who want to take even more pride in your country or your adopted country, Professor Sharma's book is for sale outside this room. There will be a book signing afterwards, not just for Brits, actually for everyone who happens to buy the book. Up here, you could queue up on this side if you want to have your book signed by Professor Sharma. The next lecture here for the Cold War Studies Center on the 12th of October is a public debate on Mao, the Chinese Revolution, and after, with Jung Chang, author of Wild Swans, and John Halliday. That's on the 12th of October at 6:30 p.m. in this room. And I have to mention, on the 29th of October, the inaugural lecture for the Gilda Lehrman Lecture Series in American History here at LSE, Professor Gordon Wood, presenting on the origins of American constitutionalism. Thank you all very much for coming.